You should balance the reputation of the study section and also the pay lines of the institute. So if NIA is not funding, you know, at a very, very low level, and NHLBI is funding at a higher level, you might want to steer it more towards NHLBI. And so people do that. But honestly, you know, I'm a big believer, be careful what you ask for. And I see this a lot in journal reviewing, being an editor, is a lot of times that people will say, get this person to review, and the person will savage the paper. And the person that they say, don't get this person to review, I'll assign anyhow. And knowing that they think the person's biased and the person will give a very balanced review. You can't always predict how things are going to play out. And so I wouldn't spend a lot of time. Did you want to say something?
Not at all.
The light?
No, the noise.
The noise,
the feedback.
I
either turn off the mic.
Amelia
talks about it now for something.
Oh, this mic. Gosh,
yeah,
I'll work on it.
Oh.
I didn't
think
my
it's hard.
Wait, did you just say I talk loud? No, sorry. Okay. Okay. So you know, there are a lot of myths out there. Like, there's a myth AHA doesn't fund clinical work, and there's a myth that, you know, sometimes things change also. So, for instance, ESTA may not have been interested in clinical work, and then they had a couple of clinical people, and all of a sudden they're funding. So that even your mentor may say, don't do this, or don't go to this place, and it may be out of date. So be a little bit careful about that. In terms of how to pick a topic, I cannot begin to emphasize how important it is that you're really jazzed about it. Has anybody here ever applied for an RFP that they were like desperate to get the money and then they got the money? Yeah. You know, and, you know, I'm 5 years into this grant and I'm like, you know, I know I was desperate for the money, but, you know, it's like if you are not completely thrilled about your topic when you are applying for it, after you've been working on it for 5 years, you're really not going to be too happy. So don't pick a topic just because it's trendy or because your mentor thinks it's a good idea or it's like really hot and going to get funded. I mean, make it something that really, really excites you. That's kind of interesting. It's also important, is it going to help you build an identity separate from your mentor?
No, it's just giving Peter the thumbs up sign because
of the blinking. Okay, so... You know, if your mentor is the world's leading authority on pregnancy and heart disease, I'm making that up, then you probably don't want to have your first R01 be about pregnancy and heart disease, because your first R01 is going to build towards your second R01, is going to build, and, you know, it's going to be hard to figure out how are you going to be separate from your mentor. Or maybe it's like just a little bit different from that. Maybe it's cardiovascular risk factors. You know, if it's too closely aligned with something that's always going to be, you're always going to be in your mentor's shadow, think about that and try to think of something that you have a track record in but will distinguish you from your mentor. Another key thing is people can come up with a really great idea, but it's kind of a one-trick pony, and after you're done with it, you're kind of done with it, and you've done it. And you need to be thinking about, what is my next grant? So when you write your first grant, what's your next grant? You should know when you're writing that grant, when you're writing your K, when you're writing your R1, where you're going. And in fact, particularly for training grants, you should say what your R1 is going to be. You should build into it where you're going. And to bring this back more to a clinical context, if you're proposing a pilot and you're doing a one-page summary, executive summary, where is that pilot going? What kind of data is it going to generate? What's going to be the follow-up project? What kind of deliverables are you going to get out of it? What kind of outcomes or results will you get? And you need to be kind of specific about that. In terms of getting started, I don't know about you, I've never written a grant where looking at the blank page hasn't driven me completely stark raving mad. I mean, it's just like, you know, my bathroom is clean, okay? Like, I wrote a grant that I hadn't written before. my email is in pretty good shape. You know, I mean, that first draft just about kills you, at least for me. After I have my first draft, I'm like, okay, fine, now I'm good, now I can change it. But the first draft can completely kill me. And so, you know, if you haven't written a grant before, it's not cheating to ask to see somebody else's grant. I have never written an administrative core. I emailed everybody and said, you know, give me your administrative core. I'm never going to write a basic science grant. I'm not going to compete with them. You know, you need to see what other people have done to see how to structure things. I mean, there is a lot of this is similar, and you don't have to start from scratch. Ask to see people's critiques. So look at the pink sheets, and look, that's what they're called, you know, they used to be called, they used to come on
pink, I guess. They used to be pink. Now they're PDFs.
PDFs, but look at the critiques and see, you know, what are people going off on? Are they focusing on the fact that you don't have any blacks because you're from Framingham? Is that a big theme these days in the study section? Because a lot of the critiques, it's interesting, we're going to come up to this, but actually you can almost pigeonhole. And in fact, when I write up my paper reviews and when I write up my study section critiques, I will put a tag word for each separate bullet, each separate, like, generalizability, for instance. And first of all, it cues the person in. What is the crux of the issue? It cues in the writer or the applicant, what the key issue is. And also, when I'm presenting, I don't have to read the whole thing. It's like generalizability, yeah. Okay, generalizability, and then I can go and speak, you know, in full sentences and not read my critique. So it's important to see other people's critiques and see, you know, what is the type of feedback you're getting. And look at the NIH reporter. I mean, if you're interested in pregnancy, you should see what they funded. First of all, you'll see what institutes are funding it. And you'll see if you've got this great idea, but by the way, they've already funded three things on it, it's going to be tough. Okay, because it's not going to be that novel. And so you really can go to NIH Reporter and get a lot of very interesting. And you can also, by the way, I mean, if you're going to another institution and you're meeting with colleagues, you can PubMed them. You can go to NIH Reporter and see what kind of research they're doing, particularly if you're looking for a job. If you walk in and you already know, wow, you know, this institute, you know, is really interested in mitochondria, that's important information and makes it look like you've done your homework. Do people know about NIH Reporter? Have you gone there?
It used to be something else, right?
It's Chris, you used to have
Chris. Yeah, it's the same thing. You can go in by principal investigator. You can see, you know, how many people from BMC. You can go in by organization. This is actually how we found out who had K's in our institution, was going to NIH Reporter, because, well, don't even get me started while we had to go to NIH Reporter, but anyhow. you can put in keywords, mitochondria, and see what's getting funded. You may find mitochondrial grants in, you know, environmental, NIE, you know, the National Institute of Environmental and Health, whatever. So there's a lot of really good information here, and I would highly, highly recommend that you use it. Now, I talked about this in the beginning, how important are the specific aims. I can't begin to emphasize to you how important they are. Because it's kind of like reading the foreword of a book and really understanding how does that book fit into the, you know, a classic, the lexicon of American literature. It really sets up the entire grant and allows you to read the grant so that you don't have to wait till the end to get to the punchline. This is what they want to actually do. And in the one page, what do you want to communicate? Why it's important, what else?
What you're gonna do.
Yeah, what you're gonna do, so your specific aims. why is it important? What else? What are the things that are graded? Has everybody downloaded the NIH? There's actually a template that we have to form, that we have to fill out. And if you don't have one, we'll email it to you. But basically, you want to check off all of the little categories. So why is it important? Public health significance. And this is true for basic science grants also.
Innovation.
Is it innovative? Is it novel? Okay. Is the environment and the investigator such that you can really pull it off and uniquely suited to do it? I like that word, unique. The investigators are uniquely suited to carry out this blah, blah, blah. Okay. So why it's innovative, what your aims are, what hypothesis do you see? One of the problems with EPI that a lot of people go at us with is, you know, it's all trolling, you know, it's all, you know, basically fishing, you know, oh, let's like cast one and see what we pull in. So you want to state a hypothesis so that people understand at the end of the day, you know, were you right or wrong? And it's like with a paper, you really want to articulate what is it that you set out? What are your expected results? Okay. And again, the team environment well suited. For a training grant, it's very important to communicate. How does this fit into the rest of your career? Because, you know, they're not particularly interested in giving you a training grant to defer you growing up. I mean, they want it to, you know, they don't want the training grant to go nowhere. They want to know what's the logical step. Okay, what do reviewers want to read? Novel science that answered an important question. And by novel, is it going to shed new insights? Look at an understudied population. Use an innovative technique. They want to know, is this not something that I've already read? If the answer has already been answered, if the question's already been answered, and maybe you're just going to put a tiny little icing on the cake that's completely baked, that's not a grant. That's a paper. Clinical relevance. And again, the specific name shouldn't be in such technical jargon that essentially your parent couldn't read it and understand basically what you're doing, what it is you're setting out. It's basically the combination between family reunion and elevator speech. It's really should be at that level. So what? By the end of the grant, how will the field have been furthered? What do reviewers not want to see? Now, I want you to, a slick presentation cannot rescue ho-hum content. But when it's interesting, when I get an application the first go round and it's a bit sloppy, I will put in the other comments, I put in the major comments. Those are the things that typically I discuss in the study section. Then there are all the other minor things about how to do better science that I will put and won't necessarily mention out loud. But, you know, I try not to let it influence my score too much, the first application. But I remember one person who I had said, I'm concerned about this, and they sent in their specific aims, had 5 typos in it. And then I moved it up to a major critique. Because if somebody is that sloppy about their grant application, you can only wonder what they're doing with their science. Especially if somebody said, pay attention to this. Not a good strategy. Okay? The grant actually got triaged. You know, because it's like I couldn't fund it. This says, hello again. How y'all doing? Thanks for coming. Glad you could make it. You know, regular readers of this feature may have gotten the wrong impression about me, that I'm sick of science, that I don't like the NIH, that I think the NIH is a crowded, festering cesspool that favors MDs over PhDs, that I think the job market is terrible, that science is cruel and unusual punishment, etc. Well, that's just not true. I love science. I love NIH. I would tell you all about it, except that, what an ironic turn of events. I'm out of space. Yeah, I like that. That was pretty good. National Institutes of Correction, Nevada, and Renovations. That's good. Okay. What do reviewers not want to see? There are some people who do such a beautiful grant, and it's kind of empty. Like, if it's so, you know, beautiful figures and the fonts and, you know, that's not going to, you get to have some ideas, some content there also. So no typos. Avoid paragraphs. How do people feel when they get a page and it's one line paragraph? I just want to shoot myself. I mean, it's kind of like, let me breathe here. It's too much. You know, topic sentence, say it. New topic sentence. You know, let people, and the paragraphs don't have to be all squished together. Okay? Have subject heading so they know what they're getting into. It should have a logical flow, no grammar problems, correct the references. If all the references are messed up or some of the references, it kind of makes you think, sloppy. It's not good. Micro font. This is also, by the way, true. Who's reading your grants? Is it people your age?
I've seen review committees literally refuse to look at too small a font.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I have had the dubious distinction of having a grant returned to me because I use Times Roman 11. And, yeah, so now I always use Arial 11. And so they will return grants, okay, if the font's too small. But similarly with papers, with manuscripts, people, all of a sudden everybody's using Calibria 11. That's a very tiny font. And it means your reviewer, your paper reviewer, has to use their reading glasses, and immediately you're going to piss them off. You know, you rubbed in their face that you're a young Turk, and, you know, they're an old fart. So don't go there. Make it big. And this is another one of my special things. There's something about turning 50 where you no longer get abbreviations or acronyms. I don't know what it is. I used to get all of them TNTC, too numerous to count, but it's just I don't. And I actually, in all of my grants now, I put an abbreviation table. You know, because it's just really freaking annoying to get partway through and somebody uses the same abbreviation. You can't figure out what the hell they're talking about. You have to open up your computer. You have to do a PDF search and find where they defined the abbreviation, if they defined it. And then one person, this is a new one. I had another person who recently tried to get around this by putting an appendix with literally, I counted them, 98 abbreviations. And it's like, first of all, some of the things that they used that they abbreviated weren't in the abbreviation list, and some of the ones that they had in the abbreviations weren't in the document. It just was like, okay, now this is just like reviewer torture, okay? You know, the point isn't to bring as much pain. You know, it's like getting a root canal to have to read something. Like, it's all gibberish.
Well, a root canal doesn't necessarily necessary.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I'm in trouble. So please, if you're going to use more than 5 abbreviations, toss a teeny abbreviation table. It breaks up the text. You basically want one figure or one table pretty much on every page. Okay, breaks up the text. Sloppiness encourages concerns about the quality of your ability to conduct good research. And if you have a beautifully written grant, it's psychological. You sit there thinking, this person has an incredibly clear mind. I don't know anything about CKD, and I'm thinking, wow, this is a great grant. Okay? So it's very important. And it makes it easier for people to read the science if they're not distracted by how crappy their writing is. And this is also important. I think I already confessed to all that I made my poor husband read all my first grants. And, you know, he's an architect. But he's actually happens to be a great writer. And it really helped with the grant, partly because if he could understand it, that means that I was communicating decently. Okay, now, what are common pitfalls? And I want to do this as an exercise, and I want people to say what, you know, for each one of the things that we're evaluated by, what are the common pitfalls? So what about significance? What would be a common pitfall? Do you want to just...
Like, you haven't done literature review? Find out.
Yeah, what would be a common mistake that somebody could... what I want is for each one, you know, significance, innovation, investigative team, etc., what would be a common mistake that one could fall into that would be one of those taglines that I told you about. So, for instance, for approach generalizability, you know, they're studying, like, you know, all white men 50 years of old that live in Dubuque. You know, you wonder about the generalizability about that. So for significance, what would be a potential pitfall in the significance?
It's not a common problem, or it's not important from a financial point of view.
Okay, so not a common problem. Now, can you have a rare disease? Can you study a rare disease and communicate to a study section why it's important? How?
It's a prototype for a kind of a pathophysiologic mechanism that is appropriately...
Right. So there, you know, something, it doesn't have to be common to be important, but you have to think about, why should anybody outside my field care about this? How would you, let's think about, I don't have good basic science examples. Can you think of something?
I can think of something sort of, not exactly like this, but so a lot of times we study PCBs. They're banned.
Okay.
Why would we ever study them if they're banned? I mean, they're persistent, so there are other reasons. But you could also say that they structurally resemble other chemicals that are currently in the environment.
Right.
And therefore, they're worth studying. But that's sort of an example of making something that doesn't seem very important.
Relevant.
Important.
Okay. I read a grant where the person wanted to study a drug that had a very, very bad impact and had been withdrawn from the market. And he wanted to understand the whole everything about that. And you're sitting there thinking, well, you know, who cares? The drug's off the market. Well, he did a very, very beautiful job. Basically, the analogy I think of is it was an autopsy.
Mm-hmm.
You want to understand what is it about this drug that we got so far down into to the point where, you know, hundreds of people or thousands of people had this very, very serious side effect. And it took us so long to withdraw from the market. So, you know, he ended up framing it and actually did a beautiful job explaining why it was an important topic. So, you know, if it's not a major public health, again, think about it. It can be a basic science topic, but you have to bring it to why it would be relevant to the public health. People say, wow, you know, that's a really great technical grant. I mean, they will know everything there is to know about, you know, factor X. This is a big one. It's not fitting into a conceptual model. Where does this fit into all of the other diseases or all of the other conditions or all of the other risk factors? Or how do the aims all tie together? That can really save a grant. I try to have a conceptual model figure in every grant that ties together the aims and explains what my hypotheses are about the overall condition I'm trying to study. Because otherwise, again, you get into this thing about, are they just on a fishing expedition?
You know, just one other concept with this is that sometimes you actually don't fit the conceptual model, and you're talking about shifting the model.
Exactly.
The model.
Paradigm
and
shifting.
The paradigm shift, and that's an even more important reason to, want to lay out the expected conceptual model.
That's actually a very important point. So, for instance, my first grant was on vascular function, and they just didn't buy it. They were like, you know, who cares about inflating a cuff on somebody's arm and deflating it, you know, after 5 minutes? Like, who cares? Like, why is this not going to just be generating more data that means nothing? And part of what we did to save the grant was go into what is our specific conceptual model about how it related to risk factors, how the vascular function then led to disease. And we did a figure in part to communicate that. Picture's worth 1,000 words. I think the conceptual model figure is critical. Again, this lack of a stated hypothesis. You know, if you don't have a stated hypothesis, essentially no matter what you find, you win, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's not science. That's just kind of, you know, trolling. And again, lack of generalizability. If you've got such a specific topic or such a specific subgroup, You can do that. So, for instance, there's a study on Finnish, 50-year-old men, but then you better really understand how that's going to extrapolate. Or if it doesn't, find an investigator who's got some different study group that is complementary. So, for instance, I'll do it in, I may have a multi-PI who can study it in African-Americans, for instance. Okay, innovation. What would be pitfalls with innovation?
Not.
Not. That's good. Yeah, I mean, basically, it's just incremental. That when we're sitting at study section or when we're sitting at the circ editorial board, I mean, that's like the kiss of death, incremental. It's like, you just kind of, you're inching the field forward 1 millimeter, but that's it. That's not a grant, okay? What about investigators? What are common problems with the investigative team?
Putting too much time for a very senior investigator.
That's a very important one that people don't realize. Is, you can put, Dr. X, the world's leading authority on microRNAs. But by the way, he's on everybody's grant and he's on for a crazy amount of person effort. And look at his other support page and he's like, already funded up the wazoo. It's not going to fly. It's interesting. I've also seen these things where very, very junior people put everybody in the universe. And it's kind of like, payback time. It's like everybody who ever did them a favor. Writing grants is not about doing favors for people. It's about getting the best team available to do the science. And so you don't have to pay everybody back who's ever put you on their grant. Okay? Really think about, when you write up the budget justification, don't write something generic. This person's a great expert. Tell them what they're going to do for you and your grant and your science.
I think you can get in trouble the other way, too, is not putting them on enough.
So what do you think, Shabri? You think she's come with that?
Having your biostatistician for 2%.
Right.
Got some major analyses.
Not giving them enough time that they can actually do what you're saying they're going to do. That's one of the classic things that I see in our study section. There always says that they have one statistician that reads every grant. Well, if you have a statistician on, you're not going to get an EPI grant in your case. It just isn't going to happen. Because most statistical methods at this point are just too bloody sophisticated that you can sit and hack it out on PC, SAS or whatever, even if, you have some background. Similarly, interestingly enough, I think even basic science grants now, they're really looking for somebody who's got quantitative skills and, decent power calculations, decent analytical method. Do you use the right test? Are you accounting for multiple, correlated data? If you're probably even in the last decade, a major amount. So do you have, and if you're, for instance, if you're doing a grant on, vascular function and outcomes, and there is nobody on the grant that really is an expert on vascular function, or the person's on for 1%, or, you're planning on doing confocal microscopy or something, you really have to make sure that people can actually carry out the, have the expertise or talent.
One of the other kind of common pitfalls I'm seeing on investigators included is that people miss disciplines. They have a long-term intervention study or some kind of prevention role, and there's no behavioral science component.
Exactly, yeah.
Just like I think most people now know you're not going to get funded if you don't have a statistician on your grant. Likewise, really, sit there and think, do I have the appropriate disciplines to assure the expertise
right.
for each potential obstacle, pitfall, step in the process?
Right, right, exactly. So, is there somebody who understands behavioral medicine? Is there somebody, depending upon your grant,
yeah.
it's going to be very, very helpful. Great.
Another thing is, don't wait till the last minute to invite these people to participate in your team, because if you invite them as sort of an afterthought, you know, you're not going to get the quality involvement that you really need to develop a good product.
Right, that's true.
I've seen people get attacked if they had that before, and then they go in for a bigger grant, and they weren't productive in the previous grant, so they didn't see publications. And I've seen study section go after those people and say, well, lack of productivity,
right,
blah, 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 and personally attack people because they don't think they were productive enough to be able to then carry out this next thing. Why should we give them more money?
I think that's very important, is, you know, did you actually carry out the specific aims of your last grant, or, you know, or maybe you published a lot, but nothing on the last grant.
Or if you're junior, actually, it's actually problematic, too, in cases, is that you don't look productive enough. There's too few publications. They start counting, and then they kind of go after you, and that's actually a very hard rebuttal to come back at so quickly, because it's just like, I don't have enough pubs, so how many is enough? But right now, obviously, they're not happy with it, so if you go back in right away, it's not a critique you can really alleviate very easily.
Right, and it's not just the amount, it's also the impact. Okay, so for instance, I saw a very, very senior person who hadn't published much, and everything that they published in like had an impact factor of one. Now, we all know impact factors are flawed, but not everything you publish should be in low impact journals. I mean, you know, some things, you know, or the lowest impact journal in that particular field. Because obviously, you know, fields also vary, you know, by how much they get cited. So you have to be careful about all those things. So again, for case, particularly training grants, is it clear? Have you made an articulation of how it's going to build to the next phase? Lack of publications in the field, lack of completion of prior funding aims. Have you all gone in for renewals of your grants? Have you done renewals? I've never done one. Partly because, I mean, I'm always kind of like still publishing like 5 years later on, you know, the grant that I did, you know, completed five years ago. It just, Effie, I guess, is kind of slow. And it's really hard to get a renewal because you have to finish your grant and really have published, you know, and you know. So it's very hard to get renewals funded. Again, key lack of expertise. And the other piece that people don't talk about, but have you ever seen somebody who's got so much funding, you're sitting there thinking, yeah, you know, like, why do you need another grant? Like, are you really going to devote the time to this? You know, there are people who have 5, 6 grants, 7 grants, and then they put them on for 20%, and those grants aren't dime. Then you start thinking, not sure. Okay. What are common pitfalls for the institution or environment? What is that? I have to be honest with you. I didn't understand what that meant. What does that mean? Is the air good? I mean, I didn't really understand what that was until I sat on study section. Do you know what that is, what they're going for with institution? Does that mean only people at Harvard can get grants funded?
You know, I've looked at, seen it most commonly used in terms of, you know, if you're looking at mentorship capabilities. Somebody's coming in with a K grant and they're at an institution that has no track record having young faculty with Ks at them. That's going to be a real problem. The other common pitfall is that a person's coming in with some population-based science and it's not clear that they have guaranteed access to populations.
Right.
So, you know, there's some real mismatches. And you need to know the track record of what is your institution been able to do. Because to say that, you know, you are now there and the institution will be able to do things it's never done before,
right,
is always going to have a pretty high credibility.
Right. So, you know, you're out in, you know, institution that's never done anything with nanomedicine, and you're proposing some really highly innovative, completely cool nanomedicine grant. But there's nobody at the institution who's ever done this. You didn't train in the lab with somebody who did it. You just think you're going to kind of pick it up on the side or something. I mean, looking like you're a hobbyist is not a good strategy. the other piece, and this is tricky because they actually do try to fund institutions that don't have a lot of R01s. But if I look at an application and nobody's other support has an R01, I get worried. I get worried, are they really going to be able to pull this off? You know, so think about the other people that you're putting on your application. And you don't want everybody who's, you know, extremely well-funded, but there should probably be at least one person who's got decent funding. So, there's a lack of specific mentoring plan, experts in the field, space, that's a big one. You know, if your institution isn't guaranteeing that you've got space, that you've got access to a mainframe, if you've got a very heavy quantitative grant, that they're not supporting your career, that they're not giving you protected time, that's very, very important. Please.
The other thing with the K grants I've seen is that if your institutional support letter or plan does not specifically outline the fact that you will have a job regardless of whether or not you will get K funding, it will ding you.
Yeah.
So if it's sort of like, if it's not clear, it's like, oh, well, she will become blah, 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 they'll ding you. If it's not guaranteed that irrespective of whether or not you get the K grant, you will have a job and they will support you in the fullest capacity, then they'll ding you. So it's, I think people underestimate that, and they come back and they're just like, you know, how do I fix this? I'm like, they're either going to have to be very explicit in the letter, or they're going to have to sort of have some sort of guarantee, or you're going to have to wait till you get promoted before you go on for that grant, because the study section doesn't like it if there's some instability with respect to whether or not you'll still have a job if you don't get the grant.
Right. Because basically, you know, why should they fund you if your institution doesn't have enough faith in you to fund you, essentially, or give you a job?
It's underestimated, but it happens all the time.
Yeah.
I think protected time is an awfully big hurdle sometimes, too. It depends on, that's where that institution environment is really important. If there's not a good track record of the institution providing protected time,
right,
it's a gamble.
Right.
As far as the funders are concerned.
Right. And the other thing in terms of a mentor's plan is it's not enough to say, oh, I'm meeting with Joe Schmo. It's like, when are you meeting with them? How often? Particularly if you've got mentors that are not at your institution, that can be highly problematic. Unless, you know, you've got a plan. I actually, you know, will meet with them. They're at, you know, Mass General. I, you know, go there Wednesdays at 1 o'clock and attend their lab meeting, and afterwards we meet. Very, very, very specific, concrete, how you're actually going to meet with your mentoring team. Okay, how about the approach? Now, this is where the epidemiologists go completely nuts. Okay.
A lack of an approach.
Yeah.
Lack of validity of the science.
Okay, what else?
Feasibility.
You're going to collect 100 patients, but you haven't collected one. Yeah. They're not going to, you've got to demonstrate, unless it's an R21, you've got to have preliminary data that shows that you can pull it off, that you can make measurable, reproducible measurements. This is true of basic science also. Can you, what's the classic one for a basic science grant? Do you have, I mean, you know, in terms of the what you need in order to, before you actually even submit the, yeah.
Pretty much have that 80% publication.
Right. And the other piece is that if you're proposing doing something with a mouse and you don't have the mouse in hand, forget it. You know, don't. I mean, that's why we were going to put on our program project last year, and the guy says, oh, yeah, you have your mouse? It's like, no. Okay, fine. You're not going to get funded. The whole project will go down if you don't have the mouse in hand. So, there are things, if you're going to do vascular function and you've never done vascular function, and you don't have really good reproducibility, or you can't say, if you say, well, the reproducibility of vascular function is blah, 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 but it's not vascular function in your lab, then it's kind of like, yeah, you know, that, because, you know, essentially, especially in human studies, the noise can completely overwhelm any signal. So that's very important. And I imagine that's true also for basic science grants, that there's so many different experimental conditions that can completely, if you don't have a real protocol and haven't worked out most of the details of, you know, how you collect the specimens or whatever, how you do it, then it's going to be problematic. So one of the classic ones is if a grant is over-dependent, if basically, if your first aim doesn't work, then essentially all the rest of your aims go down. One aim can go down, but if all the rest of the aims are dependent on one aim, that's not going to work. And like, for instance, if your first aim is, I will collect 100 patients, no, you know, that's one of the classic ones. The timeline, overambitious, unrealistic, or absent. Every grant should have a timeline. And this is true also, by the way, of, you know, when you're doing a proposing a pilot project to your boss about, like, you know, rolling out a quality project, you need to have a concrete timeline of when you will do what by what time. Confounding, you know, is there, you know, are you, for instance, if you're doing a grant on lung function, you don't collect whether somebody smokes or not, forget it. You know, it shows that you don't know the field and the left, don't know what important variables you need to collect. The approach not worked out. If the you have to have the stat methods reviewed by a statistician, at least for a clinical grant. I don't know about a basic science grant, but absolutely don't ever bother putting in a grant if you haven't had a statistician either write the stats section or at least review it and tell you, yeah, that'll fly. Power calculations. I can't stand the trust me, you know, type grants. I want a table with the different scenarios. For this effect size, I can empower to detect it. You know, I want to know all the different scenarios about for, you know, if it's you're looking in the entire population or you're looking in half the population. So a table for power calculations, I hate it when they just write them out. Needs to be easy to understand. Don't say it in gobbledygook that only, like, you know, a PhD statistician could understand. With multiple testing, how are you going to handle that? This is particularly true for the clinical. Am I going over? Okay. This says, I can prove it or disprove it. What do you want me to do? That's a chief statistician. So you have to have a statistician involved. Features that wow the reviewer.
Do you want to talk about the statisticians available on campus?
Yeah, go for it.
Just that there is through the Department of Medicine, if you're in that department, you can get a waiver. We employ a statistician who can review. If you're not, the CTSI also has consulting. I think Howard Cabral is their statistician. You go to their website and they have a form saying, this is my grant I'm working on, and I have a statistician review it. I don't know how other people have found statisticians to help them.
Well, generally, if you have to have a statistician on your grant, then you would have them review your grant, right?
Or probably write that section.
How do you find that person?
Somebody work for
them. I'm thinking like someone from the educational side who wants to measure some effect of a pedagogical intervention.
That's important. That's a big hurdle, I think. And hopefully what, you know, people can use this. We now have a core, at least in the Department of Medicine. What were you going to say? You raised your hand earlier.
I had a question related to the approach section. In terms of the grant structure, there's been a little section of the approach about dealing with sort of anticipated problems or, you know, and sort of like, well, what are things that could go wrong in your grant? I can't remember the exact.
Yeah.
What could things that go wrong?
Anticipated problems and how will you address them? Yeah.
And I guess I was looking for your thoughts on that because I've seen some people not address at all, and some people actually write a section and then it raises all these problems and reviewers kind of then attack the problems. And so it's kind of a double-edged sword. And
if you've got decent reviewers, which at least in my study section, they're great reviewers, they know the problems. It's kind of like when you write a paper and you think, well, maybe I just won't raise it and they won't figure it out. I mean, come on, you know, people are not stupid. These are the leaders in your field. They know the problems. And at least in my study section, if you address something and say, I know this is a problem, and sometimes it's an unfixable problem.
Right.
For instance, Framingham, the people are white. I'm not changing that. You know, I mean, it's unfixable. But you address that, you know, you understand that that's a limitation and you state it and, you know, you're actually in some context where there actually is an advantage because, for instance, if you're doing a genetic study, you know, it's my problem with population stratification, for instance. And so, you know, address the problem in an intelligent way because your reviewer, at least in my study section, people are really smart. I think it's pretty unusual that there's not some major issue that they don't pick up on. And I've never really found that raising an issue, like, suggests it to them. They already know it. I mean, I don't know. I personally, I mean, in fact, sometimes I have too long a limitation section, and people will, you know, say that's kind of a little silly, but I really try to address it, because that's your best shot at not being triaged. Because, you know, if it's a fail, for instance, I'm putting in a grant now, and one of the fundamental issues, I'm looking at atrial fibrillation, I'm looking at circulating microRNAs in blood. Well, you know, what the heck does circulating blood, you know, RNA, and have to do with the heart? They figure out that's a problem. So I want to have the opportunity to put my spin on it. And, you know, I spent a weekend trying to find references that pay where it's been done in other model systems like cancer or heart failure or whatever. So that's my first argument. My second argument is to take a limitation and say, but there actually also is an advantage to it, because it turns out that RNAs that show up in multiple different cell types are more likely to be regulatory, are more likely to have higher effect sizes, are more likely to be important in nodes. Do you see where I'm going? So yeah, you've got to acknowledge the limitation, but say either how you'll address it. So, for instance, ideally, I would have had CBCs at the same time, so I could do you know, principal components. Unfortunately, I don't have CBCs at the same time, so I'm going to replicate it in multiple other studies. So, again, you've got... I can't begin to emphasize how important it is to bring up the major issues, not the stupid stuff, but the major issues that any intelligent person in your field would raise. You raise it first. You get there first. I do that in papers. Partly because, you know, at the end of the day, what do you want? Do you want a p-value or do you want to advance science? So I would rather, in a paper, I have the same philosophy about papers. In a paper, I would rather tell people what the limitations are so they don't think that I'm, you know, describing, for instance, I wrote a paper on atrial fibrillation and the risk of death. It's my most cited paper. I didn't say that it was causally related. There's an association. It's important that people understand what the limitations of the data are so that they don't overinterpret it. And I think it's the same thing with grants. I don't know. What, do you all have different philosophies? Anybody else? Okay. again, I think the conceptual model is very, very important. It says, due to recent economic conditions, Pixar work has dropped to an all-time low of 842 words. Again, it has the added benefit of breaking up the text. When should you start an early career investigator? When should you start working a grant? I was saying it in the bathroom. This is like, do what I say, not what I do. I swore I wasn't going to start on my PPG too late, but anyhow. Yeah. You can't start too early on any grant, but particularly for a first grant, particularly in a field that you don't know particularly well. Like if you know a lot about X and you want to kind of move a little bit closer to field Y, you just can't start too early. And I think that's true also if you're trying to ask for money for anything, whether it's a quality improvement or whether it's a curriculum or, you know, you need to put your best foot forward. Your first shot is your best shot. You want your grant to be discussed the first time around. And that means you want to get scored and not triaged. And that's why you can't start too early. Because if you don't get discussed, you have that double jeopardy problem where they may come up with a whole new set of issues because they didn't discuss it. And somebody in the study section knows, well, you know, the way they measured their sleep measure, just like nobody uses that instrument anymore. I saw on page blah, blah, blah. Well, that can come up on the first go-round. It doesn't matter. Grants aren't about what's fair. It's about trying to find the best science. And so you've got to get your grant discussed on the first go-round. The specific aims in your stage have got to be formulated a minimum of 3 months in advance. If you're thinking about going in for October, your specific aim should be written right about now. Because you want people to be able to go up to them and kick the tire, right? You want to show your specific games to lots of different people. The first draft has to be completed 8 weeks in advance. Again, you want people to kick the tire. You really want people to critique it. And I highlighted your mentors and your colleagues need to have at least 1 month in advance. And for me, if somebody is expecting me to read their grant, they need to put that in my calendar. I don't want to find out. I worked with one person. It drove me freaking crazy. She used to send me grants or, you know, even internal grants, you know, pilot things. And she'd send them to me and say, it's due tomorrow. Shoot. You know, this isn't, you know, what is it? What is the expression? Your urgency is not my emergency. I mean, it is. If I expect, so I'm putting in this program project. I worked with Boston months ago. I'm going to need you the grant now. You know, you need to book it in advance. Everybody that you expect to read it. And this says you cannot start too early. Budget. With this much grant money, only experiment we can do is flip a coin. Don't under or over budget. Okay? If you over budget, they're not supposed to let that affect what they think about the grant. They're supposed to evaluate the science separately. It just pisses people off. It just does. And it's like, it's like they wanted to buy 5 computers. They wanted to spend $5,000 for each trip. You know, they want to, you know, whatever. I mean, it just, if it looks like there's a lot of fluff, it just encourages people to start. A, you don't want them slashing your budget. You want to have the budget you want. But also, it just makes people mad. You're not supposed to let it affect the science, but it kind of pisses you off. That, you know, it's like, what do they think, I'm stupid? You know, they're going to charge, like, you know, $1 per SNP? No. And it doesn't cost $1 per SNP. I mean, I think you understand. The other piece is, don't under budget. Now, I mean, the first grant I put in, I asked a very senior person who should go nameless, and they were somebody who did mostly lab work, and they said, oh, you got to get rid of $100,000. And that was the only piece of advice I ever took from the person. It was a mess. Because I didn't have enough money to, you know, I got the grant. I didn't have enough money to do the science.
Okay. Don't forget to put in the increases in salary.
Increases in salary. That's
You know, I have to say as a reviewer, I get more concerned. You know, you're not supposed to let your critique of the budget affect your review of the grant. But if somebody comes in really too low on budget, I think they don't know what they're doing.
Right.
Well, they don't know how to get it done.
Right.
And that always scares me, even though I know I look at them separately. It really just tells me that they don't know how to get this done.
You know, people's, even with the modular grant, I worry with the modular grant.
Yeah.
I have to be honest with you, with every single grant, account for every paperclip and phone call. Because you don't want to get the grant and then discover you don't have enough money to do it. So I literally go through and I put, you know, how much each person is making. I put in their increases. I put in the travel. I put in, if I'm going to put in publication costs, I put in the publication costs, which are not trivial. You know, sit down. We actually do a budget seminar twice a year. And it's very important. Sit down with somebody who's done a lot of budgets and make sure that you really have thought of everything. And look at other people's budgets. What happens if it doesn't get a good score? Regroup. That's, you know, this is like, you get a lot of rejection in this business. I think my record was 5 in a row where I was like, you know, I canceled my 50th birthday. You know, that's writing grants. And you go through these phases where it's like your magic. Everything gets fun. And then you go through these phases where it's like, you know, I'm toxic. Like, I'm never going to get another grant fund. Maybe other people don't go through this. Have you ever gone through a bad spell?
Yeah. I think it's like batting slumps. I really like it's the same as baseball.
Yeah.
Success begets success and failure begets failure.
You have to have a thick skin. And how do you deal with the critiques? Somebody said something really stupid.
I'm high for a week or two. I mean, I'll be real honest. You know, if I can't take it, I just don't look for 2 weeks. And
yep.
Then I feel myself up.
Tomorrow's another day.
Yeah.
I'll think about that.
Girl,
yeah. What about, you know, somebody says something that's really asinine?
Get over it. It's like, ignore it. It's stupid.
Whatever you do,
I
don't go there. Do not go there.
I actually once, you know, it's sometimes you get rescued. I once had a grant that was very borderline score, and one of the reviewers critiqued that I didn't have the established people at my university writing letters of support. And it was kind of like one of the program people read it as code word for you didn't get enough men. And so I went and through the institution and I sent in a supplementary packet of 15 letters of support from every guy at the institution. But it was just, you know, sometimes you look at it and you say, they didn't see this, did they? Yeah. You still have to respond.
You still have to respond, and you have to go into a Zen place. And it's,
yeah.
And you don't say, well, on page 5, I clearly blah, blah, blah. You know, just say, on page 5, there is this. Da-da. Everything is neutral. It's kind of like when you go up against the boss that you can't stand. You know, you go into kindergarten teacher voice, right? Like, everything is pleasant, and we love each other. Kumbaya, blah, blah, blah. It's very important that you never get emotional in a response. And that's true also for your critiques for manuscripts. That, I mean, I've handled a lot of manuscripts at CERC, you know, 1,500 or something. I mean, it never goes well when you try to take a reviewer on. Because guess what? Who has the power position? They've got the money, you know. They've got, you know, or they're the person who's going to say yes or no on your manuscript. Don't go at them. Yeah.
See, that's tricky because I had a colleague who was sending in different grants and to the same study section, and I think probably got the same reviewer who attacked this person personally for not enough publications. And it was so blatant in the comments, because they were almost like wording in terms of the investigator, that this investigator went to the program officer, expressed her concerns that she was getting personally attacked by a single reviewer, and obviously for two different grants, had gotten bottom half the first 2 months. This is when NIH still had a 3 submission, went back in and got funded third round in, from going unscored for the first 2 rounds to funded third time around by having their
review. Has anybody ever contested a review?
I haven't, but someone I collaborate with did.
Was it successful?
Yeah.
It's extremely, I know the stats at CERC, it's even manuscripts, basically it's less than 5% successful. Okay,
you know,
appeals. And what happens when you appeal? Just piss people off. You make the project officer look bad. You make the study section look bad. You know, I don't personally, in the long run, I've never appealed something. In the long run, I don't think it's worth it. But maybe you know, I have seen it work. But it's the exception, not the rule. And so you need to think very carefully if you want to lose your political capital on something that is potentially losing. That most likely, if you're a betting person, is going to lose. And all it's going to do is make people mad. Now, having said that, if people go into personal attacks, that's a little different. And then it's worth an offline conversation with the project officer.
I was just going to say, case I know was a program project where the major critique, the scores of the individual components were all good. The major critique was that the leader of the project was not strong. And again, this was the first program project they saw come in with a female lead. And, you know, the feedback filtered through that there was a sense that this was just a gender issue. They didn't see leadership as a characteristic of this individual, even though there was obvious scientific leadership. So it can be really, really tricky, but if you get a clue or a cue from somebody in the program area.
It's pretty unusual. I have to say, people say that it happens. I think that's extremely unusual.
Yeah,
that there's
rare.
Stuff.
We were surprised actually what happened.
Yeah. I will say what the best approach is. You can say, Some people think that is controversial. There are people who think the opposite. We'll explore both. You know, for instance, it's a stat method. We'll explore both. Yeah.
I don't know if you're going to talk about this. I don't want to digress too much. But there's something that I think would be important to talk about is sort of the program officer and conversations with the program officer. Because I've been given very bad advice by two separate program officers where it was to the point where it could have completely turned me off of grant writing. And both times I went back in and both times I got funded. And it was unbelievable, like the type of feedback I got and sort of like, you know, sit on it for 2 weeks and I got pissed off and stubborn and went back in and then went to a different study session, got it the first time. So I was like, you know, sometimes I'm wondering, I mean, if people always say these conversation programs are so important, do what they say, but, you know, there's a borderline there where I've learned that program officers can sometimes give pretty lousy advice. And that's just been my personal experience where I've had both my K and my R21 where I've got kind of attacked. And both times I went back in, I'm like, I'm not funded.
I had the opposite thing where I didn't get funded and my program officer read a thing, you know, chin up, you're a good scientist, you know. And, you know, I was very young at that point and it really, you know, meant a lot to me. I have to be honest with you, I haven't spent a lot of time talking to program officers. I feel like most of it's written in the critique. But I know other people have gotten a lot of really great advice from program officers, but I've had people, somebody said, oh, you know, you're close to this, you know, you're below the pay line, you'll get funded, don't bother with the resubmission, and boom, you know, they wasted a year waiting for the money to, you know, get a comment that came. So, you know, they're people. You need to get advice from lots of different people, and they're only one person.
I do think, though, that if they send you something asking for questions, about your grant, you know, five or six specific things, if you turn that around in 48 hours, you're going to be in a lot better position than if you wait a week.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, if they ask you, you know, can you give us this, and this, and, you know, you just boom. You know, that's something that's really important.
You get one page to respond. Quote verbatim. Just pick little phrases, quote verbatim to make sure and hit every single major thing that they do. And you can actually fit it on one page. Have everybody read your introduction. You know, have the janitor read your introduction. That's your chance. Do it. If you do disagree, do it with respect. Setbacks are opportunities. I mean, I have to be honest with you, one of the bitterest grants I never got funded in retrospect was a good idea. I wanted to do a Canada Gene study. The person said, no Canada Gene. You know, it's like, that's passe. And I was really deeply upset about it. It's like such a, you know, relief. You know, I saved 4 years of my life doing something that was going to end up in, you know, a quaternary journal. So, you know, they're there to help you out. Resiliency. Can't begin to tell you, you know. Conflict of interest statement, senior author's promotion, first author's job, depending on the study. You know, get involved with your professional organization. We want people in the study section to know you and see you at meetings. Thank you.
New and early investigators versus
Is
that?
In my study section, you get to give a point for, you know, you get to give, I'm sorry, it's like a softy thing, but, you know, in my study section, one person usually may says, come on, there's a new investigator, give him a chance, give him a shot, you know. That works your first time, you play well, better deliver after that first R01. There's a lot of pressure to get the second R01, because you've got to knock it out of the ballpark with that first R01. But I think in most study sections, everybody remembers what it was like to get their first grant funded. And in fact, we've had, you know, one of the things that my guy says is show them the love, you know. If you're going to find something, you know, book, you know, give them a great score, you know. I mean, we don't make funding decisions, right? That's the other thing.
Right, I just wasn't sure, like, what specific things are you differently when looking at an early investigator.
I tend to give them more of the benefit of the doubt, unless something is not feasible. And then I want to save them the heartache of having a grant that's going to go that way.